welcome to episode 53 of the Two Chairs Talking podcast. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Perry Middlemiss. How are you, Perry?
Pretty good, thanks, David. Pretty good. Had my first vaccination last Friday.
Yeah, big jab.
Walked up and got it all done. It was all done very easily and no side effects, which my daughter is quite annoyed about because she actually was feeling rather unwell after she had hers.
I felt a little bit ratty the next couple of days, but not too bad.
I've been okay. The only thing that I had was a slight tenderness in the arm, which I think is fairly reasonable given that somebody stabbed me with a bit of metal.
Yeah, very reasonable.
And that's all. You know, maybe you could put a bit of a touch of tiredness down to it, but not really very much. We're all fine. So I think both of us, David, would heartily recommend that everybody goes out and gets a vaccination when and where they can.
Exactly. And regardless of what variety it is, just get vaccinated.
Yep. Well, I went for the AstraZeneca.
Yeah, me too.
That's basically all that's available to the over 50s in
you
Australia.
To us oldies, yes.
And that's fine.
Yep,
I'm all right.
I'm comfortable. Nothing wrong with it. As long as we've got something. Yep.
No.
All right. So, anything going on in the world out there?
Yeah, a couple of things that I thought I'd like to mention before we get started into the main body of today's podcast. We don't really mention horror very much on this particular podcast. I don't read very much of it. I have read a reasonable amount in the past, but should be reading more, I think, because there's some good stuff going around. There's always good stuff. The top level of all the genre stuff. I mean, it's all generally pretty damn good stuff.
True.
And the reason why I brought this up is the for a couple of reasons. Firstly, the Bram Stoker Award, which is the major horror award given out every year, was announced today. You know, it could have been, was probably somewhere in the US, so it was probably earlier today.
Yeah.
And the winner of the novel is by a gentleman called Stephen Graham Jones, who is building up a very major reputation in the field. And his novel is The Only Good Indians.
Okay.
Which of course, is a cut-down version of The Only Good Indian is a Dead Indian.
Uh-huh.
This is a horror novel that I have heard very good things about. He actually did very well because he won two major awards in the evening when these were handed out. He also won Superior Achievement in Long Fiction. They don't say best, they say Superior Achievement. And he won that for a novella called Night of the Mannequins. Probably a good thing to read the novella first to see whether you think you like his style. I've read one novella by him and I was quite impressed by it. So I'm quite happy to go and have a look at his other stuff when I can get to it, David.
Indeed.
There's also an award for screenplay, which basically means leads to film, really, I suppose.
Sure.
And the winner this year was The Invisible Man, not a film that I have seen.
I've seen it advertised, but that's not.
Yeah, it was up against things like Colour Out of Space, which obviously was a Lovecraft thing, and then Lovecraft Country, Season 1, Episode 1, and Season 1, Episode 8, and The Haunting of Bly Manor, Season 1, Episode 5. Don't know that one at all.
No.
Anyway, so basically that's the major award news that I wanted to mention today. But the other thing in the horror genre, which I only came across in the last couple of days, is an unpublished werewolf novel that has been discovered in the papers of a late Nobel Prize winner by the name of John Steinbeck.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, what a weird thing. John Steinbeck writing a werewolf novel. You sort of have a bit of an interest in that, thinking, what the hell could he do with it? Actually, I would read it just purely on the basis of thinking, there might be something really interesting there. Mm. There might be something absolutely derivative and not very good at all.
Well, it's quite possible.
You know, it's worthwhile giving it a whirl and see what you see what happens. But anyway, I believe the publishers or whoever's found it is still negotiating with the literary executor to try to get the rights to be able to publish it. I don't know why it wasn't published That hasn't come out just as yet, or if it did, I didn't read that deeply into the article mentioning this. I was just taken aback by the fact that there was a werewolf novel by John Steinbeck.
Yeah, goodness, that was enough.
Yeah. So yeah. I thought I'd bring that up and sort of say, well, fair enough. There we are.
Mind you, I must say that you know, some of the early or first or early novels of some writers, even though they would go on to become great writers, some of the early stuff should be buried, I think. Wasn't it Melville, Herman Melville, who threw his first manuscript overboard from his ship? You know, he just didn't want anyone to see it. But anyway, it may be okay. But I'm just thinking of some other writers like, you know, Wilkie Collins or so on. Some of their first couple of novels are just not worth looking at.
No, some of them weren't. I mean, regarding Melville, there might be some people around saying that he should have thrown his Moby Dick manuscript
overboard. Oh, no, it's a great classic.
I haven't read it.
Oh, well, you should.
Of course I should. There's all heaps of stuff I should have read, but just
available for free from Standardy Books, I might say.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, here, another plug. That's good.
Yeah, another plug, that's fine.
Yeah, why not? You know, take the opportunity when you can get it. That's what I say.
Yeah. So you've been talking about horror, but I almost never read horror. I think the closest I come is a bit of Stephen King, but it's just not a genre that appeals to me much.
Yeah, he's sort of on the edges of it. Well, you could say that he's a mainstay, but I think there's a whole lot of people that have moved away from where he is, and he doesn't do a lot of the splatter stuff. His stuff is more suspenseful terror, if you like, rather than pure unadulterated horror. Yeah. I was never a fan of the real splatter stuff.
It never appealed to me. It doesn't interest me. No.
I'd much prefer that build-up of tension when it's sort of unnerving as you read it. You know something bad's going to happen, you just don't know what it is.
That's right.
That can be, you know, you look at some of his really fantastic stuff, like Misery, for example. That's just an exercise in continual tension building all the way right through. Wonderful stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, great stuff, yeah. All right, well, I'm going to roll on. And I've got a bit of a theme this episode.
Oh, okay.
Which is the fact that I seem to have been reading a lot of nonfiction this year. I usually read a bit of nonfiction, but this year I seem to have been reading a good deal more. And it's covered a wide range of subject matter and length of the book, ranging from Barack Obama's autobiography, A Promised Land, which is a doorstop at more than 700 pages, to a tiny book I just read, which has got a lovely title. It's a tiny book. It's only about, you know, I don't know, 5 centimetres on the side. It's called Why You Should Read Children's Books, Even Though You Are So Old and Wise, by Catherine Rundle, which is a tiny little book, and it's only got 60 small pages. It's really just an essay when it comes down to it. But it's really interesting little read. And anyway, as it happens, I'm taking her advice and I'm reading Catherine Rundle's children's book, Rooftoppers, at the moment, which is very good. Anyway, I'm not going to talk about either of those books today. Both of them might get a mention when we talk next year about our best reads of 2021. Anyway, I'm going to talk about 4 different nonfiction books, which I've really enjoyed recently. And the first of these is a book called Deep Sea and Foreign Going by Rose George. Now, this one's all about the shipping industry, the industry which, as the author tells us, transports 90% of everything we in the developed world use or buy. But in many ways, it's an industry which has, in a sense, become invisible. People are not paying much attention to it. There was a time when most educated people were aware of what was going on in shipping. You know, they knew about shipping routes and they knew when certain ships were going to arrive on their shores or leave their shores and what goods they were carrying, because they were closely, you know, affected by what was going to be available, or if they were shipping stuff themselves, it affected the viability of their businesses. But very few people these days ever think about shipping or about how the goods they buy in the supermarket or the hardware store got there. Now, the first thing I have to say is that this book was written quite a while ago. It was published in 2013, so there may well have been changes in the industry since then, probably have. But at the time when she was writing, there were some 100,000 freighters travelling the world's seas carrying goods. I imagine that the numbers only increased since then. And the biggest container ships, again at the time she was writing, The biggest container ships could each transport 15,000 of those standardized shipping containers. And on the drawing board, again, when she was writing, on the drawing board were even bigger ships being able to carry up to 20,000 such containers. Now, in order to write this book and understand the whole business better, Rose George, who turns out to be, I think, is a British investigative journalist, she arranged somehow to travel as a guest on board a huge container ship, the Maersk Kendall. It was on a trip from the English port of Felixstowe to Singapore, which is a trip that was going to take her 5 weeks and covers more than 9,000 nautical miles. It wasn't very easy for her to arrange that because it's not something that the ordinary person can do. And in fact, most of the shipping companies these days are very secretive about the quality of life on board for their workers who, really have to work very hard in terrible conditions. So she was lucky that Maersk was willing to grant her access and let her travel on board the ship. I thought it was a really, really fascinating and very educational book about something we do take for granted. So Rose George gives this vivid first-person account of traveling on board the Maersk Kendall, and she has many discussions with the captain and with some of the workers, and she observes what their conditions are like. And then later, when they reach the Horn of Africa, she transfers for a while to one of the Navy ships which are hunting down Somali pirates, or trying to hunt down Somali pirates. And her book's packed full of information. It's just every page has got something interesting to learn about the shipping industry on it. For example, shipping is now so cheap that it's so cheap per item of cargo anyway, that it costs less than 1 cent per can to transport a can of beer the nearly 17,000 kilometres from England to Singapore. And it's cheaper to ship some raw materials from England to, say, Thailand for processing by the cheap labour there and then return it home to England than it is to process them in England. But at the same time, George's book includes very depressing information about how much pollution these huge container vessels generate, basically burning diesel fuel, and how much they damage wildlife in the sea. So everything gets sacrificed in the name of profit. So I thought this was a very interesting book. It was well worth reading to understand something which really is so fundamental about our society, but which we normally ignore or don't even think about. So, yeah, it's well worth reading.
Shipping generally turns up when something goes wrong, a bit like
That's right.
The recent event of the Suez Canal where that ship ended up sideways.
And blocked a huge amount of the world's commerce for a period of a week or two. That had huge impacts on everything else.
I think people are a bit shocked as to how much was going through the Suez Canal and how narrow it actually is.
They can only travel one way, they bunch up, the ships bunch up at one end, and then they go through. It's like one of those, when you stopped at a roadworks site, someone holds up a sign saying, go slow, or they turn around and say, stop, and it's kind of like that. They only allow one ship at a time through in each direction. Anyway, one of these big ships, anyway.
Well, it's a fair way, and if you look at it and think, it must be that way because the ship wasn't, well, it wasn't completely sideways, but it was probably at a 45-degree angle to what it should have been. And it was completely wedged on both sides.
Jammed at both ends, that's right.
So, as you say, it's not exactly wide, but the amount of materials that go floating through. And also you've had a few films about the Somalian pirates basically hijacking ships by coming up really close, and most of those ships don't have any weapons to defend themselves. They've really just got water cannon, and that's about all they have. And, if somebody comes in late at night and you don't see them and they come in stealthily, well, then you can be in trouble.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's interesting. Look, it's a fairly major part of, as you say, of the world's commerce. There have been talk about how some of them, some of the container ships are so vastly overpacked that you barely, this big one in the Suez Canal, because it was stuck at both ends, they were saying that the weight in the middle was might well have split in half, and if it had sunk, they were in deep trouble because
it
would have taken them months to be able to get it out. Hopefully they can come up with a better way of doing this by using sale or something rather than diesel all the way, but who knows? It's not a very nice industry, I don't think.
I think that's very true. And this book, you know, points that out. You know, it's vital, but it's not very good.
Well, it's just been allowed to run rampant because corporations are running it, and when the market rules at the lowest price, it doesn't rule and in favour of anything other than the market. Mm.
Mm. And again, she points out there's almost no control because most of these ships sail under what they call flags of convenience. They're registered to Panama or Liberia or somewhere, who get great fees from doing that. But they take no responsibility, and so the conditions for the crew and the actions that the ship can take is basically it's like the Wild West. There's just no real control.
No, it's not good.
No.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll move on to something a little bit closer to home. The first thing that I want to talk about today is a novel called The Yield by Tara June Winch. This won the Miles Franklin Award for 2020, last year's award, so it was published in 2019. Tara June Winch came to national attention back in 2006 with her first novel, Swallow the Air, but she's been rather quiet since then, probably working as an academic. I believe she now lives in Paris, but she's probably been working away in the background. She did, in 2016, she put out a short story collection called After the Carnage. So it's taken another 3 years after that for this, her second novel, to come out. But it's done very well. It's won a few awards. So I'll give you a bit of a background about it, then I'll talk about it. A bit of a detail about what the story's about. Wurundjeri elder Poppy Albert Gondawindi has died. He's the grandfather of the main character in the book, August Gondawindi, who travels back from England to a hometown of Massacre Plains in western New South Wales to attend his funeral. Now, when you come across a town's name like Massacre Plains, you know there's a history here. And it's not a very nice history. And that a lot of that starts to come out in the book. So August comes back to her hometown to live with her grandmother, Elsie. She tries to reconnect with her because she hasn't seen her for about 10 years. She tries to get to know what's going on in the town. And the whole time she's there, she keeps running up against things that are missing. Things like her mother, who's languishing in jail on a drugs charge. Her sister, Jetta, who disappeared 12-odd years ago, was lost and has now been presumed dead. She's missing the Wurundjeri language, her language, the history and her country. So there's a whole lot of things that she's missing, but a lot of other people are missing as well. Now, the town's in a bit of flux because it's waiting for a large tin mine to open up, an operation that promises to deliver a large number of jobs, but in the same way as shipping commerce is going to cause a lot of damage all the way around the town. There's questions about sacred sites, about artifacts that are going to go missing and what impact this is going to have on the town itself. So the time of this particular book is leading, for the most part, up to the funeral. However, there's two other streams that are running in this particular novel. So there's August's stream, which is her learning about the town, reconnecting, remembering what went on in the past. Now, there's something that at the beginning of the novel, August doesn't know, and that is her grandfather, Poppy, was creating a dictionary of the Wurundjeri language. Yeah. And so one stream of the novel, every third or fourth chapter, is a listing of terms that he has documented. But it's documented in such a way that his explanations of those terms slowly, as you get into the novel, start lending more information to what is happening to August and what has happened to her family and what's happened to her country over the period of years. And so it slowly starts to bring the information out about what happened to her sister and what's happened to everything around them. There's another stream as well, which goes back to a major letter, which was written by a priest, a Lutheran priest, back in the 1860s, which he's written to 1880s, 1890s, and he's writing to his bishop explaining what has happened in the area in which he's lived and what he's gone about doing, his history. So that's told in chapter blocks. He came in, he sets up a mission with the aim of helping the local indigenous population because he believes they are being treated really, really poorly by the local pastoralists and the local town people and hunted by the men in the area. And so you get another view of what this history has happened to everything, and that leads up to the thing about what's happening. It sort of fills in a lot of the history of what's happened in the past.
Hmm.
So there's these three different threads that slowly come together all the way down through the beginning. And it's interesting that Poppy drops a really big major hint about what is going to happen later in the book in his very first entry for his dictionary. And he talks about a yarran tree or a spearwood tree or hickory acacia, which is Yarani in his language. And he states here, from it I once made a spear in order to kill a man. Now you just think, oh, I'll just pass that off. Three quarters of the way through the book, you then understand what the hint is that he gives you right at the very beginning. This is an excellent book and really handled very well because you could basically get all these threads completely lost and sort of not utilise them properly. You could use the dictionary as just bland dictionary entries just to bulk things out. But the author hasn't done that. She's utilised that as a mechanism of pushing the plot along, giving the reader more information. So just about all the way through this book, the reader knows more about what's going on in the background of the story than August does. And so you are trying to figure out how she's going to work out what you know and where things are going to end up. It's handled really, really well. And I thought it was an excellent book. Well, also the other thing that I really liked was the dictionary is got entries that go backwards. So it starts at Y. He's got nothing that was starting with Z in his language.
Okay.
It starts at Y and it ends with A.
Okay.
And the A word that he's got is Australia. And I thought, I read that and I thought, oh, that's really clever.
Mm.
You come all the way right through, you do everything through with this particular book, giving the details of the Indigenous people in the area. And then you get to the end and you say, Australia. And he says, now, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this properly, so forgive me of that. Gurambang is the name of the Wiradjuri language for the country. And he says, that's my country anyway. It spreads to almost the size of England, from the mountains in the north to the boundary of the Narambung in the south. And then he goes on to explain it all. And then he says, can you hear the word? Can you hear the word? This is my word. This is the word for our country. And so it's really excellently done, really fantastic book. I really enjoyed this.
Hmm.
And I gave it a rating of 4.4 out of 5. I was really tossing up as to whether to push this up to 4.5. It was one of those ones where, would I round this up to 5? And I thought, not quite. There's a couple of bits where I think that could have been handled just a little bit better, but by God, it's pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
And I would recommend that that people read this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does sound good. I must look that up. Indeed. All right. Okay, well, I'm still continuing with my nonfiction. And the next book I've got is called The Shape of Sound by Fiona Murphy. Now, this has just come out, or relatively recently just come out, and it's from Text Publishing, and it has a cover by a certain W.H. Chong,
who
is a friend of the podcast. Excellent cover, as usual. Anyway, what's it about? It's an autobiographical book about the struggles of someone with severe hearing difficulties, in a society which takes hearing for granted. And it's kind of a unique coming of age story, which pulls you in and really generates a great deal of empathy for the author and really for anyone who is not considered to be, quote, normal, end quote, particularly when they're a child. So Fiona Murphy was born completely deaf in her left ear, a condition which wasn't diagnosed until she was about 5 years old, even though she had fairly normal hearing in her right ear. Because of this deficit on the left, she, as a child, she had great difficulty in understanding her teachers and in following the conversations of other children. As a result, she struggled both with learning to read and with, you know, social relationships with other children. Nevertheless, she and her parents resisted the idea of her being sent to a special class or a special school for the disabled. But unfortunately, this was at a time when teaching children sign language was frowned on. And even today, this attitude has not entirely changed. I'll talk a bit about that again later. But she was given some sort of assistance in the form of hearing aid embedded into a pair of thick glasses, to, you know, sort of embedded in the side of one of these, the frames of these glasses. But these just added to her embarrassment of being different from other children, as you can imagine it would. But because she had partial hearing, she always felt pushed just to try harder to hear and to understand. And she felt ashamed of her difficulties. And this early experience caused her problems throughout her life. So growing up, she spent decades of her life trying to cover up her deafness, and she wouldn't admit it even to her close friends. She was always tense trying to understand discussions by purely by means of concentrating really hard and paying really close attention to people. She was able to graduate from university and work as a physiotherapist, but she continually suffered stress and headaches as she struggled to communicate with her clients without admitting that she had difficulty in hearing them. She has some very critical comments to make about the hearing aid industry and how hearing aids are portrayed as a panacea for people with hearing difficulties. But for most people, they aren't a panacea. She says that many audiologists are motivated to recommend expensive devices because they receive a commission on each sale. But studies have shown that only a few people fitted with hearing aids continue to use them for a matter of years. Generally, they tail off and stop using them. Certainly, they didn't work for Fiona Murphy, and in fact, her first trials, which she documents with a hearing aid, came close to traumatizing her, leading to her to have feelings of bewilderment and despair. You know, she's unable to use this so-called panacea to fix her problems. In retrospect, she believes that she would have benefited greatly from being taught sign language as a child. And she talks a good deal about how sign language education is still not fully accepted in our society. And the focus is still mainly on technical interventions such as bionic implants and hearing aids, which might help some people, but by no means all people. She considers that to be, which I think is true too, a terrible shame. Unfortunately, in her late 30s, Murphy started to also lose hearing in her right ear due to a rare condition which thickens the bones in the ear. These tiny bones are what makes hearing possible. But worse still, she began to suffer badly from tinnitus, which is essentially a noise which is generated by the brain itself, trying to fill in for the loss of sound from the ear. But finally, beginning to come to terms with her situation towards the end of the book, she re-engages with the idea of learning Australian Sign Language herself, AUSLAN, the Australian Sign Language, and she starts to make connections with the Australian deaf community and learn about deaf culture and deaf history, in fact, which is quite an interesting part of the book. So I found this book it was gripping. It was a very honest account of one person's struggle, not just with disability, but also really with her whole identity, her place in society. And it's got a great deal to say about how society as a whole deals with those people who do have various deficits like deafness. So very much recommended. By the way, I was struck on reading this true first-person account of deafness on how well Emma Viskic has portrayed her deaf character, Caleb Zelick, in her crime novels. I just saw lots of parallels between Fiona Murphy's experiences and those that Viskic writes into her character, particularly his reluctance to admit his deafness, even when doing so would seem to make life easier for him. So just more credits to Emma Viskic for having done a pretty good job, it seems, in handling that aspect of her books. Yeah, so it's good. But anyway, going back to The Shape of Sound, it's definitely, I would recommend people read it.
Okay, it's
particularly
good.
when you're like me, and probably a bit Perry, you're starting to lose your own hearing a bit. It's certainly the case with me.
Yeah, I haven't noticed much of a drop off, but I'm certain there must have been some,
There's a
going
lot
to
for me.
too many loud concerts when I was younger, and standing in the wrong place and that sort of stuff. And I think it's just gradual degeneration over time that I know my father was losing his hearing near the end of his life, so I assume that similar things are going to be happening to me.
My father was stone deaf by the time he died.
Okay.
I mean, he just, we could, and he'd never learnt sign language, and he found the hearing aids pretty well useless. And so we used to have a whiteboard, and we used to write messages to him on it. It was the only way we could communicate. So,
Okay.
yeah, that was pretty sad.
Well, it is, but you do what you can
You do what you can,
to communicate. And because I was listening to somebody talking about, it may well have been this book on a podcast recently, saying that there was a lot of problems with children not being learnt a language in their early years, because
Yeah, very much so.
they miss out on a lot of things, including well, just culture and how the brain works, and how it can form words, and how intelligence works to get the information and process the information. If they don't get that in the first 5 or 6 years, they are going to struggle for the rest of their lives. And not teaching children sign language is one of
It's
those
almost a
things.
crime, I
Well,
think,
it is. I think it is almost a crime. I mean, I have to say, I'm very pleased to see that there's a lot more acceptance of sign language now, when you're seeing that just about all major press conferences given out by major governments use have somebody signing next to them. And some of them, basically, we saw Dan Andrews, the Premier of Victoria, when he was giving his press conferences day after day after day in 2020 for regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, always had somebody next to him signing, and they would just roll over. They would have two or three of them, and they would do 5 to 10 minutes and then change over on a regular basis. But it is good to see that that sort of thing is happening, and that people that do have sign language are firstly being catered for. But for those that don't have it, like myself, and don't know anybody that's deaf enough to be signing, it just keeps in the forefront of our consciousness that there are these people there that you have to be wary of. I worked with somebody once, I remember, way back 30, 40 years ago, who was deaf and was able to read lips. Her problem with me was that I had a beard. And so I had to, which I still have, but makes it very difficult for some people to be able to read lips with somebody who is bearded. So I learned very quickly that I had to basically make sure that I faced her directly, full on, that I held my head up high, and that I spoke slowly to her, and then always asked, "Did you get that? Do you want me to repeat it?" And it wasn't a demeaning thing that I had to do. I just had to make sure that she was getting the information. And it's just things that you have to do that you have to be wary of. And that's just the way that it is. This book sounds really interesting.
It is interesting. Just before I leave that topic, she mentions a few times reading a book by Oliver Sacks called Seeing Voices, which I recommend too. It's a really fascinating book, and there's a lot in there about sign language and deaf culture. It's well worth reading that book.
Oh, just about anything by Oliver Sacks is
Oh,
worthwhile reading, I
absolutely.
think. I
That's
read a
true,
couple of
yeah.
things by his in the past, and again, he's somebody else that I need to go back and revisit.
Sure.
Well, I was mentioning a podcast earlier. Well, now I'm going to actually review a podcast that I don't think we've mentioned many of them
No.
on this particular podcast. So we've don't want anybody to go off and listen to anything else, David. That's probably what it is.
Well,
Just stay with us. We're the best choice of source of information you can have.
yeah.
Anyway, the one that I'm going to be talking about is a new one. It's only been out. It's only done one season of, I think it's 8 episodes, and they're all about 30 minutes a piece. This one is called Sideways. Now, I'll spell this for a reason. It's called Sideways, Sidewayes, as you would normally spell sideways. The reason why I've spelled it is because it's written and presented by best-selling author Matthew Syed, but his surname is spelled S-Y-E-D. So there's a nice little thing there sideways, but, you know, I guess the BBC didn't want him to do S-Y-E-D ways because they would have thought, no, that was just too cute. Actually, I would have preferred that. I think that would probably be a good idea. But anyway, the whole idea of this particular podcast is that he, Matthew Syed, looks at ideas that are in common usage that shape our lives, but he takes a different slant on the story and looks at them from a slightly different perspective to give you a different view about what you think you understand. Now, the first episode deals with the term Stockholm Syndrome. Now, you and I would, David, would understand this as being a situation where people in a sort of a kidnapping situation, the victims have a tendency to start relating to their captors much more than to the police and become sympathetic to them. And the longer they stay there, the more sympathetic they become. Well, Syed basically goes in and has a look at this and he says, this is a load of crap. What he does is he examines it right back. So he goes right back to the very beginning of where Stockholm Syndrome came from. And if you look up, there's a nice piece on this in Wikipedia. Now, the term was first used by the media in about 1973 when four hostages were taken during a bank robbery in Stockholm in Sweden. They were held by these two particular fairly violent terrorist-like guys. What these two guys were trying to do was to try to not so much get the money, but to get out of the country and get away. Basically, because one of them came in first, and his first demand was that you have to release this other guy. So the cops release the other guy, and he goes in, and then there's two guys in there. And you think, well, that was a bit silly right from the very start. And so the weird thing was that the hostages defended the captors while they were there and after being released and wouldn't actually testify against them in court. Now, a whole industry was built up about this particular incident where people would make a lot of money out of this idea that this sort of syndrome existed. Now, it's worked its way all the way into basic life because now it's used by a number of people to give an explanation as to why people don't leave things like domestic violence. Why don't you leave, you know, why don't you leave if he's belting you? Oh, you know, I've got this relationship with him and I'd sort of, yeah. But these two situations are completely different. You've got a bank robbery where somebody's holding a gun to your head and you don't know them. In a domestic violence situation, you've had a relationship with this person for months, if not years. There's a vastly different interaction between the two things that go on here. But a lot of people have made a lot of money by pushing this whole Stockholm Syndrome idea falsely. And so Syed tracks down, Kristen Enmark, who was the major hostage in this particular bank robbery. And he goes and talks to her. And one of the questions he asks her is, so who came to talk to you about this? Who are the researchers? Came to you, talk to you about this with Stockholm Syndrome. Anyone answer she gave?
No.
Nobody. He is the first person that has spoken to her about this other than the media at the beginning. Mm. And he gets the story that what happened was she was in the bank as a hostage for 6 days, 7 days or 8 days, somewhere around there. And the one thing that she was attempting to do all the way through was survive. She wanted to make sure that she and her fellow hostages got through to the end. She was willing to do anything to get through. Now, that meant that she would ring the Swedish Prime Minister, which she actually did, and speak to him and pitch their case to him, which she actually did. That's what she was going to do. And she said she didn't like them, but basically there was no relationship that got built up. She was just purely and simply trying to survive. So this whole Stockholm Syndrome is built up on a false piece of information. But if you go back and look at the problem again and basically say, well, okay, let's just look at this without any preconceptions and then go in and analyse what the problem is, maybe we can come up with a different answer. And that's what he's done. This is a very, very interesting 30 minutes. It's only 30 minutes. It's really lovely piece of work that he does here. Now, in later programs, he goes on and deals with the case of a woman in Britain who was charged with and then convicted of the murder of her two children. The first child died from what was called cot death or sudden infant death syndrome back in the early 90s. And then the year or so later, they have a second child, and the child at about 8-9 months dies. There's no theoretical cause of death. And so they basically said, well, this is SIDS again. Everybody's giving her a lot of sympathy. This is terrible. This is awful. Until some expert, and I put that in inverted commas, comes out and says, oh, the chances of this happening are 1 in 74 million. Therefore, she must have killed them. And so the woman was charged. He came up, the expert comes up, gives all this testimony, and she's convicted and put in jail. It comes out later on that the chance of a child dying due to sudden infant death syndrome is about 1 in 80,000. And he said, well, if you've got 1 in 80,000 for this, 85 or 86,000 or whatever it is, and then you've got the second one at 1 in 86,000, the chances of two of them happening is 86,000 multiplied by 86,000. Well, that's just not right. Because these are two statistical incidences which are completely not connected. It's the same way as if when you toss a coin, and as you know, you toss a coin, you get a 50-50 chance. What's the chance of you getting ahead with the second toss of a coin when you've got ahead with the first one?
50%.
50-50. The third one is 50-50.
That's right.
The 20th one is 50-50. It's just when you look at the whole incidence of what is the number, what's the chance of you getting five heads in a row if you look at it as an overall event, not as an individual item. And he breaks that down. This information needed to be sort of broken out. The woman was finally released. But the whole experience had traumatized her so much that she basically dragged herself to death within 2 years of being released.
Hardly surprising.
Mm. And it's hardly surprising. And so it's, you know, the terrible things that people do when they think they know the answers to things and they put it as being experts when people aren't going in and saying, well, no, could you explain what you actually mean by how you actually did that? And if you go and have a look at it, then it's just not right. And anyway, the other thing that they found out when somebody went and did some research on the second death was the child had died from encephalitis, which was in one of the medical reports that the prosecution did not present.
Yeah.
So they were out to get this woman, basically. And then five or six other women as well in Britain at the time were also convicted because they had two children dying, one from sudden infant death syndrome and one from something else. It's just terrible what these people can do if you basically don't look at a problem properly and analyse it correctly. He then also, that's another program which is excellent. He then goes on and talks about things like how a military campaign that was developed by a Korean Air Force pilot helped the Brexit campaign. That was odd, but interesting. Then he asks a question, can anybody be a memory champion? You know, these guys that go into these memory championships that try to remember two packs of cards in, you know, 2 minutes and then have to basically give them all back in the right order. And he looks at that. He also then looks at a guy called Max Martin, a guy who I'd never heard of, but is a Swedish musical genius behind 22 number one hit singles around the world and how he did it and why he did it the way that he did. This is a fascinating little podcast.
Sounds it, yeah.
I'd recommend this.
Yeah.
30 minutes, put it on, go for a walk. You're done in 30 minutes. My wife and I listened to this while we were travelling recently in New South Wales doing driving, and we just listened to the whole lot because we just thought it was just tremendous, and I'm really glad we did. I'm waiting for the second season to come out because it'd be great. Do you remember that? Oh, do you remember that program back on the TV probably 20, 30 years ago called, what was it, Connections?
Yes.
Something like that, about the guy that basically said, what's the connection between this particular Renaissance physicist and the space shuttle? And he follows it all the way right through, all the little bits. This mean this little discovery means that this could be made and that could be made and this could be made and that got to the refrigerator and that got to this and that got to the stage where they could do something on the spaceship. Wonderful stuff.
Yeah, it was
this
good.
Is similar but on a smaller scale and done as a podcast. Recommend.
Sounds good. Terrific.
So the name of the podcast is Sideways. It's a BBC podcast.
Yeah, well, I'll spin it up on my my podcast client. It sounds good.
Do that.
All right, now I'm onto my third book, which again is all my books are this time, a non-fiction book. This is called Extraterrestrial by A.V. Loeb. Now, you probably remember all this. In 2017, a strange object entered our solar system and sped off before astronomers had much of a chance to study it. What was clear about this object, though, was that it was in a what's called a hyperbolic trajectory, which means that it wasn't going to stay in the solar system. It must have come in from outside the solar system and would pass right through it and continue on into interstellar space. And it was the first known interstellar object to be detected within our local solar system. I mean, that's fascinating enough just on that basis. But there were several very unusual features of this object. Now, eventually it was named... I'll try to get this right. It was eventually named Oumuamua. There's a glottal stop at the start of that, which I can't do, but that's why it has that little curly dot at the start of it. It's a glottal stop, but I can't do a glottal stop. Never mind. Oumuamua. And that's the Hawaiian word for scout. And that's because the first sighting of this thing was by the Pan-STARRS telescope in Hawaii. So these unusual features of the object have spurred a wide variety of competing explanations from astronomers. But A.V. Loeb, who's the author of this book, caused a sensation by suggesting that Oumuamua could be an alien artifact, quite possibly an alien light sail. Now, before you dismiss this as the idea of a crank, you've got to be aware that Loeb isn't some random nutter, but rather he's an astrophysicist. And in fact, the long-serving chair of the Department of Astronomy at Harvard University. And he's perfectly serious in his suggestion. And in this book, he sets out his reasoning, which I actually found pretty convincing, to be honest. So what are these unusual features of Oumuamua? You have to understand the best images of it that we were able to get, because it was a long way away, it was traveling fast, was basically just showed it as a bright dot. It was too far away to see any detail on it. But this bright dot dimmed and brightened over an 8-hour period, suggesting that it was tumbling. However, the dimmest part of its light curve was very dim indeed. It essentially vanished from sight. And suggestions for explaining this included the idea that it was cigar-shaped, you know, far longer than it was wide. The only other suggestion which would work would be if it was very flat and thin, like a pancake, so that in its tumbling we periodically saw it virtually edge on. Now, A.V. Loeb points out that whichever of those you choose, we've seen nothing like it in our own solar system. So it's very unusual from that point of view. Secondly, when we encountered the object, this takes a bit of explanation. We encountered the object, it was almost exactly at the local standard of rest. And what is that? What's the local standard of rest? That's what you get if you average out all the movements of all the stars in our vicinity. Then you average out all their speeds and directions and so on. And the average speed and direction of all those stars would be the local standard of rest. But that's a very unusual point to be at, because it's like if you work out the average height of all Australian women, for example, say. Very few individuals would be exactly that average height. Similarly, very few, if any, stars in our local neighbourhood are exactly at the local standard of rest. But Oumuamua was. Now, why would an alien artifact be at the local standard of rest? Well, one possible reason might be the fact that that's a very good way to cover up where it had come from, because we can't compare its motion with that of any particular star. So that's one point. Thirdly, and most importantly, as it plunged past our Sun, coming within the orbit of Mercury, and headed out, it underwent a slight acceleration, which meant that it deviated from the path we'd expect if it was just a dumb rock. Maybe it was some sort of comet and there was some sort of outgassing which pushed it off course. But no such emissions were detected even by the best instruments we have, which should have detected anything like that. And the acceleration of the object was very smooth. It wasn't jerky like sudden bursts of of gases being heated up and expelled. So it was a smooth acceleration. What's more, the acceleration fell off at exactly an inverse square rate as it moved away from the sun, suggesting that it was the pressure of light which was pushing it, just as you would expect with a light sail. I would add something that Loeb doesn't bring up himself, and that's the fact that if you think of the solar system as a target like a dartboard, and Oumuamua as a dart being just thrown at it, the odds of it hitting the very small area between the orbit of Mercury and the surface of the Sun, compared to the width of the solar system, this very small area between the orbit of Mercury and the surface of the Sun, it's very unlikely to hit that small area if it was just being, you know, arriving at random. It's basically like throwing a dart at a dartboard while you're drunk and blindfolded and hitting the bullseye. But if you have a light sail, that's exactly the place where you'd want to pass through a star system to get the most benefit from light pressure acceleration. So the author doesn't insist on this interpretation, but I think he does make a solid case for saying that his hypothesis fits the observed facts better than any other explanation which has been thought up so far. And he also really is strong on the point that we shouldn't rule out explanations involving alien technology in advance, but we should always keep our minds open to that as being a possibility. So it was a short book, but it was a fascinating read, I thought. It was very good. Well, certainly science fiction fans should read it, I think, just for interest's sake.
We've had discussions over email about this for the last couple of years, haven't we, David, on and off?
We have.
When various new articles have turned up in the popular press and also in the scientific press, if we've come across them. And it is a very intriguing object indeed. As you say, while we can't basically pin our flag definitively on it and say, yes, it was a piece of alien technology, it does not appear, at least, to be knocked out. That option doesn't appear to be knocked out easily. There's too many things that point towards that as an explanation for it to be dismissed out of hand. And as you say, the author here is not a crackpot. He is somebody that's been in the industry for quite a long period of time, and he's well renowned around the world. And he's written a fairly well reasoned argument as to why this needs to be considered.
Yeah.
We've had a few things like this, you know, like Becky's Star, I think, a few years ago, where it was the possibility that the way that the light for that star was dimming may have been caused by the construction of a Dyson sphere or Dyson swarm around the star. We've spoken about Dyson spheres before, which is just like a large artifact that goes all the way right around the whole of a star at a particular distance, like the orbit of the Earth. Massively huge thing that would be almost impossible for, well, certainly impossible for us to build, but it would have to have a really massively advanced technology in order to be able to achieve that. They're not sure that that was the case, but it certainly is one that whenever these things turn up, you can't dismiss out of hand that there may be another explanation. I don't think everybody's 100% convinced that this explanation is correct, but it is not one that can be chucked out, because there's just too many things that went on and that happened that at this stage aren't, you know, what's the Sherlock Holmes line?
When you've reeled out everything which is impossible, then what remains must be what the truth is. Yeah, well, it's possible. Yeah, I think he makes a good case for at least that you should consider this as a possibility.
Yep.
And as you say, not rule it out of hand. And it was well worth reading anyway.
All right. Definitely well worth reading. Sounds like one I'm going to have to check out, which I should think so. Okay, I'm going to now move to a couple of fantasy novellas that I've read over the last couple of weeks. These two are both by an author by the name of Ngho, Ngho. The first of these is The Empress of Salt and Fortune, and the second, When the Tiger Came Down the Mountain. The first of these has been nominated for the 2021 Locus and Hugo Awards for Best Novella. And the two of them are the first two works in her Seeing Hills series. So it's brand new stuff. The second of these is a sort of sequel to the first, not a direct sequel, but it's set in the same fantastical world using the same main character. The first one, Empress of Salt and Fortune, it's set in a fantastical fictional world, sort of somewhere like a faux Asian country of some sort. Could be Vietnam, could be a little bit of China, somewhere like that. And it follows the story of an ungendered cleric, Chi, C-H-I-H, who attempts to record the rise, fall and rise again of the Empress In Yo, who has recently died. So he's come, her reign is finished, and he's now trying to work out how she got from originally being the emperor's wife. She was brought down originally as a sort of like a trophy wife from the north and married the emperor. He wasn't overly keen on her terribly much. She wasn't keen on him. The empress preferred people of her own sex, so she preferred women to men. And so the emperor wasn't very happy with her. So he exiled her to an estate. She was rather lucky in that instance, because when the emperor basically got sick of one of his wives, he would normally take the silk garrote approach rather than exile, but he must have liked her enough to exile her. And he exiles her to this estate at Lake Scarlet. And this is where Inyo plots her revenge. She's basically feels as though she's been humiliated, and she's humiliated, and she wants her revenge. And she travels to this house, works his way through, and he's accompanied by a magical bird companion called Almost Brilliant. Fantastic name for a bird. This bird's can talk, and it also records just about everything that goes on. And she and Almost Brilliant encounter this old woman who calls herself Rabbit, who they discover was the Empress's companion during her rise and her exile, but not when she rose again. So what's happened is, while the Empress has been away in exile, she's been plotting her revenge on the Emperor, and then finally succeeds, overthrows the Empire, and then goes back and takes over again. This is a beautifully quiet, exquisitely paced, dialogue-rich novella, and it really deserves its award nominations. It's it is quite a good piece of work, I thought that it was handled very well. It's quiet and slow, but gradually things start being unravelled. The mystery starts coming out, and it slowly starts building, and you get a good sense of somebody tracking down a mystery to work out what's happening. I gave that one 4.2 out of 5. Mm-hmm. Now, the second one, When the Tiger came down the Mountain, again has Chi, without Almost Brilliant, which is a bit unfortunate because I really quite liked that particular character. In this case, Chi's trying to travel over a mountain pass under the guidance of a young woman by the name of Si Yu on the back of a mammoth, trying to travel over a mountain pass when they're waylaid by three fantastical tigers who are able to speak and to take human form. So this is a really very fantastical world that we're talking here. Now, in order for the party, that is Chi, the mammoth and CU, in order for them not to be eaten by the tigers, Chi basically starts wondering whether the tigers would like to hear a story. And they mention the story of this legendary tiger, Ho Tai Tao, and her human lover, the scholarly Diu, D-I-E-U. Now, the tigers become mesmerized by this particular story and offer their own version of events. So Chi starts talking. They get through part of the story, and the tigers say, no, that's not what happened. And then they go in and say, this is blah, blah, blah. Oh, and he goes, oh, okay. And then Chi goes, oh, okay. And then they write it down, make a note of it, saying, you know, I've got to get the record right here. I've got to make sure this story is told correctly. And then Chi tells the next bit of the story, and the tigers give their version of it, and backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. So it's similar in concept to the very first one. So it uses this idea of storytelling as a way of eliciting or working your way through a puzzle and getting to the final version of things. But I felt in this second one, the setup was rather a bit more contrived. The first one just felt a lot more natural, that he was going to a particular place for a particular reason. In this instance, Chi basically ends up landing in, and I shouldn't call him he, I'm sorry about that, that was a slip, that they are ungendered, so it should have been they. So they have ended up in a place where they can get to the story, but it just feels a bit like the ending is going to be telegraphed a bit too much in this. Still an excellent novella, it's still worth reading, though not, I think, up to the standard of the first one. So I gave this one 3.7 out of 5. Okay. But I'd be interested to see how the first of these goes in the awards later this year. And I'll probably circle back to this when I've finished reading all of the novellas for the Hugo Awards, and we'll wander through these quickly again. But I'll try to bring in a couple every now and again as we go through in the next few months.
All right, well, this is my last book you'd be pleased to hear, perhaps. And again, non-fiction. This one is called Liftoff by Eric Berger, who's a journalist who deals with the space industry. So the subtitle of this book is Elon Musk and the Desperate Early Days That Launched SpaceX, which is a pretty good summary of what the whole book's about. Now, no matter what you think about Elon Musk as a person, I personally think he's a horrible individual who has behaved despicably in many, many ways. But there's no arguing with the fact that he's been able to do some remarkable and valuable things, I think. And among them is the establishment of SpaceX and reducing the cost of launching things into space. Now, we think of SpaceX these days as being incredibly successful, safely taking humans to the International Space Station, spectacularly landing and reusing rocket boosters, even launching a Tesla car into space and beyond the distance to Mars. But it certainly didn't start off that way. The early days for SpaceX were very precarious times, which is what this book is all about. Now, the author of the book, Eric Berger, conducted many interviews with current and past SpaceX employees, including with Elon Musk himself, and together with talking to NASA and Air Force officials. And Berger turns the early history of the company into a fascinating and at times gripping read. It was certainly a book I didn't want to put down. Now, Elon Musk famously made most of his fortune through setting up what became PayPal. He didn't set out to get into the space business, but as a space enthusiast, he started looking into the development of rocket technology and NASA's plans for future space exploration by humans. But basically he found out that there really hadn't been much other than incremental changes in rocketry, and that NASA really didn't have much in the way of plans for the future exploration of the solar system by people. Also didn't seem to be much popular enthusiasm for human space travel. So he came up with the idea of something called Mars Oasis, which I hadn't heard of before. I thought it was really interesting. The idea of Mars Oasis was a project that Musk was trying to push that would land a miniature greenhouse on Mars, which would, he hoped, demonstrate that living things could grow there. There wouldn't be any humans involved. It would all just be there, presumably, as a demonstration project. You know, imagine that there'd be video cameras broadcasting these plants growing on Mars. He tried to buy some cheap rockets from Russia for this idea to carry it out, but he failed because they wanted far too much money. Launching things into space was still incredibly expensive. So that's when he started thinking about trying to make access to space cheaper. Now, he seems to have started off SpaceX with the thinking, how hard can this be? Well, as the book documents, it was actually very hard, far harder than he anticipated. After all, it is rocket science. So Elon Musk started SpaceX in 2002, and he tipped in a fair chunk of his fortune. It was $600 million, I think, he tipped in to get it going. And with this, they developed their own engine and rocket booster, which became the Falcon 1. And yes, it was named for the Millennium Falcon from Star Wars. The engine was dubbed the Raptor, for another bird of prey. And they got some early support and funding from NASA, and were getting ready to try to launch the first Falcon in 2005. But when they tried to do this at Vandenberg Air Base in California, which is now, by the way, the Vandenberg Space Force Base, anyway, they tried to launch it from this place, and the Air Force refused to schedule a date for this launch. It seems that the Air Force had been happy to lease out their facilities to SpaceX only so long as they were looking at the company as a bit of a joke, and they didn't really expect it to go anyway. But when they finally realized that Elon Musk was serious and the company had a real vehicle ready to launch, they backed off at a million miles an hour, claiming any such launch attempt would be a risk to other vehicles and facilities at the base. You can't launch it here. So SpaceX suddenly had to find somewhere else to launch this thing. And they'd now signed up contracts for payloads which would require launching the craft in an easterly direction to get it into geosynchronous orbit, a place like that. And they couldn't do that in any place where the launch path would lie over inhabited land because of the danger of it crashing. And so their prospects of finding such a spot in the continental United States without using government facilities like Cape Canaveral were slim. And after a long search, they found a spot in the Marshall Islands, which are in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, a place called, I'm not going to get this right, but Kwajalein. I'll try that. Kwajalein. It's part of the largest coral lagoon in the world. And as it happens, there's a US Army base there. SpaceX was able to lease space from the US Army because the Army was much more welcoming than the Air Force. Apparently, this base had to partially self-fund itself through commercial partnerships. And so the Army was quite welcoming, and they helped them set up a launch site on this tiny uninhabited island called Omelek, which is a boat ride away from Kwajalein. The logistics of getting all their equipment and personnel to Kwajalein and then Omelek were huge, as the author outlines in detail in the book. But to cut a long story short, SpaceX made its first attempt to launch the Falcon in 2006. Now, the rocket took off, but almost immediately there was a fuel leak and it blew up, not all that far from the ground, spreading garbage everywhere. Bits of equipment which they had to pick up, pull out of the ocean. So they tried again the next year, but there was another failure, which I now can't remember why that one failed. But it may have had something to do with the corrosion of parts in the damp, salty air of the island. So by the time they were ready to try again, the third time in early 2008, things were starting to look very difficult for the company, and the money was running out because Elon Musk was also having problems with keeping the Tesla car company afloat at the same time. Anyway, they managed to set up for a third launch, and the third launch appeared at first to have gone well. The first stage performed perfectly, but at the moment when the second stage separated from the first, there was apparently still a tiny amount of fuel left in the first stage, just enough that it was kept going and it bumped into the second stage, throwing it off course, and the whole rocket then had to be destroyed. So now things were really grim. Their original backers, including NASA, were losing faith, and their detractors were starting to say, "We told you so." And there wasn't enough money to build another launcher, but luckily they still had one left that they'd built previously. So it was do or die with this particular launcher. They had to launch this one successfully, or that would be it, they would be out of business. What's more, there was a very short window of opportunity for them to try again. Can't remember now exactly why, but there was a very short period of time in which they were able to do it. There wasn't even time, because it was this short window of opportunity, there wasn't even time to transport the rocket to Omelek by sea, which is how they've been transporting all the other big bits of equipment. And somehow Musk did a deal with the US Air Force, who agreed to lease the company space on one of their heavy lift aircraft. Now, I apologize to aeronautics fans. I can't now recall what type of plane this was. I don't have the book anymore. It went back to the local library. I should have kept it until I wrote these notes. Anyway, it's gone back to the library, so I can't remember. I think it was a Lockheed C-5 Galaxy, one of those big planes anyway. But anyway, big enough to carry the whole launcher, which of course wasn't fueled up at the time. So also on board in seats around the cargo bay were seats for most of the SpaceX crew who wanted to travel to the island, of course. Now, all went pretty well on takeoff of this plane. But as the aircraft descended to land at Hawaii for an intermediate stop, the crew started to hear creaks and loud popping noises coming from the launcher. Although the bay was pressurized during flight, there was still a difference between air pressure between flight and ground level. And just like if you were flying while you're having a heavy head cold, the pressure inside the rocket wasn't able to adjust quickly enough to the increasing air pressure as the plane descended, things went very wrong. I won't go into any more detail because you should read the book, but just to say that it took truly heroic efforts on the part of the SpaceX crew to resurrect this final chance at launching the Falcon rocket. But in the end, they succeeded and got it into orbit. And the rest, as they say, is history. But it's fascinating history. It was a really excellent read. I can definitely recommend it if you're interested in space and space travel at all. It's a good book.
Okay. All right. Another one to put on the list.
On your list. That's yep. Right.
Now, I think we're about done.
I think that's it for the day.
All right. Well, it's probably got to give the listener a bit of time off then, David. I think that's probably a good thing to be doing. So what are we up to next time?
I've forgotten. You tell me. You're the one who looks after the schedule.
Oh, am I? Oh, okay. Well, I thought this was a joint effort.
Well, it is. You come up with the schedule and I agree to it. I think that's what it comes down to.
Is that the way that it works? Okay, yeah. I wasn't terribly sure about that. I think next time we're going to be talking about fanzines.
Oh, that's right.
Yes, the fanzines that you and I have created over the years, the fanzines that are around at the moment, and the different types, all the different types of stuff that's been going on, and what it is we're doing at the moment. I think that might be an interesting little topic for us to talk about.
Well, it might well indeed.
Yep.
Oh, all right. Sounds good.
So that's what we'll do then. All right. Thanks, okay. David.
All right. Well, see you in a fortnight.
Yes. See you then.
Bye. Bye-bye.